Hello and welcome to Something's Off with Andrew Heaton. I'm your host, Steve Martin's Banjo. And today I will be talking about postmodernism. What is it? Should we love it, fear it? I don't know. We're going to talk to Nick Gillespie about that momentarily. But before we do that, I do need to give a shout out to today's sponsor. Something's Off with Andrew Heaton is brought to you by the Stop Sloth Abuse Council. Nobody wants to encourage sloth abuse. When I drive through alleys late at night and see emaciated street sloths poking around garbage cans for scraps, I think, oh, that's a shame. Why do I hang out in alleys late at night? Don't worry about it. But here's my point. You might be encouraging street sloths without even realizing that you're doing it. And that's a problem for them and for humans. Did you know that most cases of sloth rabies aren't from wild sloths? They're from domestic sloths who get abandoned by their owners and then breed. Well, there is something you can do to stop that. Spay or neuter your pet sloth. Even if you never abandon that sloth, it might get out one evening and then mate with a feral neighborhood sloth, producing a litter of street sloths. But if you spay or neuter your sloth, you keep the population managed and limit the amount of poor, wandering sloths living in dumpsters and discarded shoeboxes. The Stop Sloth Abuse Council. Quit hurting sloths. My guest today is Nick Gillespie. He is the editor-at-large for Reason TV. He's the former editor of Reason Magazine. And if you're unfamiliar with Nick, I suspect you're probably very familiar with him. But if you're unfamiliar with Nick, Nick is something akin to an archduke in the world of libertarianism, if such things existed. And I'm delighted to have him on the program. Nick, thank you for joining me.
I feel like you're setting me up. That where I come from, archdukes exist for one reason, and that's to get plugged.
That's right. They're the casus belli for starting world wars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, I wanted to bring you on to talk about postmodernism, in part because I've had a few listeners, Nick, that have actually reached out to me specifically requesting that you come on the program to talk about postmodernism. So, I'd already kind of thought about that. I will preface this with, I am by no means an expert in postmodernism. I have heard the word thrown around a lot the last 3 years or so, whereas previously I thought it was an art term, and now I'm hearing, say, like Jordan Peterson come out swinging against postmodernism. I've heard Noam Chomsky come out, and I went, God, those guys really hate Philip Glass, and I now see it's all right. It's part of an intellectual movement, but it's hard for me to distinguish what postmodernism actually is and whether or not I should hate it. And you seem to have a much better grasp on that.
Yeah. And you can never go wrong hating something because you can always make up with it. And,
okay.
The world has enough love.
Yeah.
World needs more hate.
That's a good point. I agree that would make a good bumper sticker. The world has plenty of love. Let's bring on the bile.
Yeah.
So can you give an intro to what postmodernism is?
So you're right, by the way, to think about it, in a fundamental way as an aesthetic term, because there is a postmodern aesthetic. It's related to, but it's a little bit different, what people like Noam Chomsky, who, is on the left, as well as Jordan Peterson, who's more on the right. And it's fascinating to think that Jordan Peterson and Noam Chomsky, agree.
Oh, yeah. They're just buddies slinging down beer and.
Yeah,
hating on postmodernism.
But, the definition that I use. So there's a kind of philosophical or almost epistemological way of talking about postmodernism. And in a book that came out in 1979 or 1980 in English by Jean-François Lyotard, a French philosopher and kind of social theorist, he talked about the postmodern condition as one which is characterized by incredulity toward meta-narratives. He was asked by the Quebec government to write a report on the status of knowledge and authority in kind of the sciences and in the academy. And he said, we're living in, and again, this is going back 35 years now, whatever. I'm an English major. My math skills are incredibly off. 38 years. I don't know.
What gets
us back to 1980? Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
But he said, this is the, we're in a postmodern condition where people at, across many disciplines, across many walks of life, et cetera, have incredulity toward meta-narratives. And then what does that mean? And what I take it to mean, and I think this is an accurate understanding of it, is that people are much less likely to take kind of authoritative systems of thought or declarations of truth or any kind of anybody who says, look, I've got the answers. I have a system that explains everything. They're much less likely to say, oh, okay, I get that. I'm just going to accept what you tell me from a position of authority. And it's not that we don't have grand theories, and we have a lot of different grand theories, including many that disagree with one another. So you could have, you know, a kind of capitalist understanding of a free market economy or a Marxist one or something, you know, post-Marxist or whatever. But people are like, you know what, you got to show me your math. Like, okay, why should I believe the claims that you have? And I think one of the things, and I say this as somebody who's, you know, balls deep in the libertarian movement, and I consider myself a libertarian, which I think is, like postmodernism, is more kind of a default setting or a direction rather than a set of rigid, you know, facts that we know to be true or mm-hmm. axioms or commandments or something. But I think what postmodernism, we live in a world where authority is constantly having to justify itself and explain itself, and not simply like the police at the door, but people who say, look, this is a better way to live. This is the best way to organize society. This is the best way to run a company. This is, you know, all of these things that we might call meta narratives or big stories that societies and civilizations tell themselves. And if I can just very quickly, the way that links up with postmodern aesthetics, I think, and one of the kind of key people here is an Italian philosopher and novelist, Umberto Eco, and a theorist who wrote The Name of the Rose. He's probably best known for The Name of the Rose, and is very much of a postmodern. But postmodern art, whether it's, you know, and I'm mostly familiar with literature, that's what my background is, but you mentioned people like Philip Glass and what that. Mm-hmm. Postmodern art typically, compared to modernist art or modernist masterpieces, and that would be things like in literature anyway, would be, Virginia Woolf's novels or James Joyce's Ulysses, things like that.
Those are modernists that you just mentioned?
Those are modernists. Okay. And then what postmodern is, and the way it fits in with this idea of kind of incredulity toward meta-narrative, it foregrounds its own construction and its own limits as an art form. Instead of trying to be this beautiful object that kind of overwhelms you with its completeness and its almost hermetically sealed beauty and understanding, postmodern art tends to kind of force you to understand that this piece of art, whether it's a painting or a piece of music or a novel, is constructed, and that it's made. It doesn't actually fit together as well as one might think. So it's constantly commenting on its own construction and its own aesthetic effects on you. I see that as very simpatica with postmodern philosophy. And then what I was getting at with the libertarian thing is what I like about it is that it's really postmodernism, like libertarianism, is more about the limits of knowledge or the limits of a system of meaning and explanation rather than, the power of it to solve all our problems.
Okay. And that goes back into the meta-narratives, which, so a meta-narrative, as I understand it, is a... It's sort of an all-inclusive system, or what's a good working definition? Can you give some examples?
It's like, it's a big story that we tell ourselves. So, the meta-narrative of biology and a lot of social organizations, somebody like Jordan Peterson, he relies a lot on evolutionary psychology or evolutionary mm-hmm. biology and archetypes, which don't necessarily match up all that well together. Noam Chomsky has a meta-narrative about both about language, in linguistics, but then, his whole critique of American foreign policy is a type of meta-narrative. Donald Trump is pushing he has a meta-narrative about what America was, what it is now, and
okay.
how we get back to making America great again. Somebody like Bernie Sanders has a narrative, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Elizabeth Warren, they kind of share a progressive meta-narrative, which is that capitalism is exploitative, that we are at a particularly awful moment of income inequality and unfairness that grows out of economic conditions that need to be addressed through the state. Libertarians have a meta-narrative that individuals left to their own devices will produce better, through voluntary exchange, will mm-hmm. produce far better outcomes that are both more prosperous but also more fair than if it's forced on, forced on people through government or something.
So far, this sounds to me, in what you've described, is just kind of healthy skepticism. Why is there so much ire directed at postmodernism from other people in academia, like Noam Chomsky or Jordan Peterson. I've seen a fair amount of Christian apologists that are really angry at postmodernism. From on my end, what it seems to me is that there's kind of a amorphous group of philosophies that someone might really dislike, and postmodernism sounds like a good label to put on them, but I don't know that they're actually in sync with, say, like secular fundamentalism or anything like that. They might be, but I don't know.
Right. And I'm not sure what is, I'm not sure what secular fundamentalism is.
But, I think it would be kind of the Richard Dawkins, scientism as a morality. Something like that.
Yeah. Okay. So, and atheists also, they have a meta narrative, et cetera. There are a lot of competing stories. And then there's ones that are more abstract, kind of Michel Foucault, the French social theorist, who was very much part of a kind of postmodern moment, talked about power a lot and the ways in which people in power, they force stories that don't actually account for the facts or history or anything, but they kind of paper over all the holes in it in order to maintain and assert power and things like that. I think you're right that, one way of defining postmodernism, I think in a healthy way, in a good way, and also an accurate way, is, its skepticism, and that it's understanding, that there is no truth with a capital T. There are only small t truths, and we can progress towards a better understanding of the world or of the past or of the future or of natural phenomenon and things like that, but we're never going to get there fully, that all truths are constantly being kind of revised and changed, and at various points you go from a place where you think you know what the truth is and you're sure, and then suddenly a new discovery comes through and you have a totally different system. This happens as well. And so it really is skepticism. Now, the reason why I think it raises a lot of ire, and this is funny, and this is where somebody like Chomsky, who's much more of a traditional kind of Marxian leftist, mm-hmm. And somebody like Peterson or, a Dawkins or something like that, who are not necessarily left-wing at all, but they believe in science and truth. What they dislike about postmodernism, regardless of if they're on the political right or the left, is the idea that postmodernism essentially says, look, there are no truths that will be perfectly and eternally true, regardless of context, regardless of our understanding or anything like that. And these guys, the modernist systems of thought and knowledge that came out of the 19th century, that come out of Enlightenment thought, would be Marx, Freud, and Darwin. And people who are into any of those, like they don't want to hear that they are not going to find truth with a capital T. They believe in kind of logic and progress and discovery of truth rather than the invention of truth. And hence, when you discover truth, it doesn't change. When you invent truth or when you acknowledge we only invent truth,
Does this skepticism of truth with the capital T, does this extend everywhere? So like is gravity up for debate? Are scientific debate?
Let's put it this way. It's always up for debate, but there's like a kind of triage where gravity actually works pretty well. Newtonian physics, in a broader sense, works really well until you get to a certain level and then things flip around and things like that. And I think part of what postmodernism is actually about, even though it's often associated with Europe and particularly France, it's actually very pragmatic, and in that sense, it's a very American kind of philosophy, where it's like, you are skeptical about everything, but you're not equally skeptical about all things, because it's also true that something
like it's not like an intellectual nihilism where you can't know anything. Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, that's a cartoon version of it that critics often charge against it. And some practitioners are like that. And this is, I went to grad school in the late 80s and the early 90s, and postmodernism was very ascendant, both as an aesthetic, but also as a kind of philosophical or epistemological starting point. And there were people who said that, and they would say things like, well, science or engineering truths are the same as, myths or, that the Grimm brothers might come up with, that there's no real distinction between types of discourse and whatnot. And that's, to me, that strikes me as stupid in the sense of aerodynamics that allow us to fly airplanes and know how they stay up in the air and also why they crash.
Cones are not a social construct.
Well, but it is though, in a sense, because we may get to a point where, you know, in the future, we're just thinking about stuff so differently that the whole idea of, you know, wind, you know, turbine or, you know, whatever, you know, the wind and lift and all of that is just not even worth talking about. Like, it's so out of what we think about.
Okay.
For flight or something like that. But, you know, it's different. And that's one of the things that is actually kind of interesting about postmodernism, I think, as a system of knowledge. And again, it's less of a system of knowledge, and I think it's more a temperament or a flavor, is that you are willing to recognize that different types of activity, different types of phenomenon may have different ways of, we may have different ways of explaining that. And so that the truth feel in a prize is not the same as the truth that you might do in a medical setting or something like that. And that it makes sense to kind of approach each area of human activity or phenomenon with, you know, recognizing that we want to develop a body of knowledge and an understanding of this subject matter, this area of activity that is specific to that. And there, you know, there's certain commonalities across things, but this is, you know, one of the reasons why postmodernism is interesting. And, you know, I mentioned the 19th century. The 19th century in many ways was a search for a single cause that would explain, you know, virtually everything in the world. And again, if you think about Marx, Freud, and Darwin, you know, it's economics, it's biology, or it's psychology.
Kind of a unified string theory of what's
making
mankind.
Yeah, exactly. That is, you know, a good way of thinking about postmodernism is that it doesn't believe in a unified field theory that explains
I could see that explaining a lot of the reason, to go back to your point about if you're a Freudian or a Marxist or whatever, whether it would bother you. Like, I find that in having conversations with a lot of my friends, particularly actually outside of politics, I tend to have a fairly compartmentalized way of approaching the world, where if I go to a movie, I don't necessarily connect that movie with my political understanding. They're separate fields for me. So unless it's overt, I'm not thinking about that. Whereas if I have friends that everything is political, every single thing is political, from, you know, food to movie and that kind of thing. Sure. I could see a system in which you're bucking against a singular meta narrative would be slightly dangerous to you, because it would seem to derail that.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, because one of the reasons why I've been talking about this stuff again after, you know, learning it and believing it, and it informs my thought, and it especially informs my thought as a libertarian, because again, I think libertarianism or the libertarian sensibility is one that looks at the limits of systems to explain or dictate or regulate anything in a good way. So you're always kind of epistemologically humble when you're about to tell people what to do with their lives.
Yeah, and it tends to just, I think the sort of emotional resting state of libertarians is to oppose accumulation of power. And that probably extends not just from the sphere of government, but probably somewhat reflexive to anything else, which I think would be more of Michel Foucault's position of, you know, there's a sort of power dynamic at work in meta narratives, and it's all right to question that because there might be some sort of societal control emanating from that.
Right. And I think it's very useful. And so my PhD is from SUNY Buffalo, where Michel Foucault.
Wait,
actually,
should I be calling you Dr. Nick? Are you Dr. Nick?
You should have been. Yes,
right.
I am Dr. Nick.
Dr. Nick.
Foucault, in the early 70s, he had his first American teaching gig at SUNY Buffalo, or State University of New York at Buffalo, University at Buffalo. And he was he had a correspondence with Thomas Sowers, who is a great critic, a libertarian critic of the medicalization of every aspect of American life and of psychiatry, for being this kind of monocausal arch narrative that tells, you know, that explains everything. And they actually got along pretty well. And Foucault, towards the end of his life, he died in the early to mid 80s in France from AIDS. And he was in his last set of lectures, he told his students to read Hayek and von Mises with special care, because he thought that their theories of kind of restricting the state and decentralizing power would be a way to fight back against accumulations of power, because that was like one of the big themes in his life. He ultimately did not see eye to eye with them, but there's a lot of, there's a lot of road that we travel, I think, in the same direction. And to go back to
I do want to point out, just because I think a lot of the time I find postmodernism uses a shorthand for the kind of intellectual underpinnings of Marxism or progressivism, that would militate. Well, Foucault would militate against that somewhat if he's also preaching Hayek.
He was not. I mean, he was all French and virtually all continental, thinkers are men or women of the left. But he was not a Marxist by any stretch. He was actually a critic of it. And what I was going to say is that it's when people like Jordan Peterson, and I think a lot of people on the right now, that when they say, they talk about postmodern Marxism, et cetera. Back when I was in grad school, Marxists disliked postmodernists. They saw postmodernism and postmodernism essentially capitulating to capitalism.
Marxists aren't fundamentally cosmically correct.
Yeah. And that it was, kind of like the idea was that we were going to focus more on a kind of surface, a kind of surface dimensions of things, and that, capitalism was not necessarily a bad thing, because one of the things that postmodernists tend to like is a profusion or a proliferation of identities or positions that one might take. Mm-hmm. And they saw that as kind of capitulating to capitalism, and the idea of everything solid dissolves into air, that you would... the whole point of bourgeois society and the Communist Manifesto, or the main effect of it, is that it destroys historical knowledge so that people never rise up against capitalism. And they saw postmodernism as kind of complicit in that system. They saw it as an excrescence of capitalism. There's a famous book from the 80s or early 90s by Frederick Jameson, who's a literary critic, called Postmodernism or the Logic of Late Capitalism.
Goes back to that thing that anybody you disagree with is a postmodernist. Yeah. Like I've been reading stories in preparation for this, describing how Trump is the vanguard of postmodernism because he is the post-truth president. But at the same time, also the Marxists are postmodern, and everybody you don't like is postmodern.
And then there was a period where everybody you loved was postmodern because you were roping them in. So it gets confusing, and it'll flip back and forth. You mentioned relativism, and I think that's also not without some legitimacy, but I think it's overdone. But that postmodernism is often the adjective postmodern is also often used as a synonym for relativistic say, well, nothing is fully true, so all truths are equal. And I that's the way people are thinking about it. I don't think that's necessarily accurate. I mean, I think logically it's a bad statement, but that is the way that I think a lot of people think about postmodernism.
Which we're in, and am I right in thinking you could be a postmodern relativist, or you could be a postmodern pluralist, which I would say is a whole different basket. Like a pluralist would say, you're a Methodist and I'm a baritone, or whatever,
right.
And that's fine. We've kind of got as a pluralist, we've got a set of laws and values that we all subscribe to, but after that kind of core foundation of what we need to get along in a society, you can pursue your own route, which is different than a relativist. And even then, I don't think most relativists would be okay with murder. But there is
and that is one of the Stanley Fish, who is a major figure in the 1980s and 90s in literature departments. He created the Duke English Department at a point where Frederick Jameson was, but it was like a powerhouse of kind of experimental avant-garde and postmodern theory. He was actually very harsh, and he said that, nobody is really a relativist, like where they will allow somebody to kill them because that other person's truth is as strong as theirs. And so he kind of made fun of what he called boutique multiculturalists. And I think that's right. And that's also one of the differences. Pluralists and relativists are a little bit different because you're not saying all things are equally true, which is a relativist position, but a pluralist would be, we can have a society, but we do have at least a few things that we all agree on, including, and I think generally coming out of Europe and the Enlightenment, post-Hobbes, post-Locke, in the liberal era, it's that, as long as you are not forcing people to live a particular way, as long as most things are voluntary, and that you respect each other's property, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, or life, liberty, and property, after that, we can be free to disagree on just about anything, and we'll win or lose adherence by the success or failure of our particular lifestyles or the things that we do with our lives.
I think I would fit fairly squarely into that camp of the Enlightenment era pluralist. And Adam, I'm going to kick myself if I don't. This is such a stupid question, but I've been wondering about it, and I want to ask it. How can anything be postmodern? Did modern at some point just get, did that become shorthand for Enlightenment or 19th century, and no one bothered to think that that would eventually be an outdated term, and thus you can be postmodern, or how did that come about?
Well, you know, it's a little bit more complicated than that, because now, you know, even the phrase the Enlightenment is less used than something like the modern period, or the early modern period has kind of replaced talking about the Renaissance and Reformation leading into the Enlightenment. So we talk about modernity from, you know, depending on where you want to start, it could be anywhere, the 1400s, 1500s, certainly the 1600s or 1700s. And I think what modernism or modernity kind of points to in these conversations is that idea of an overarching theory, an overarching kind of epistemology or understanding of things. And, you know, the difference is a lot of, modernism, both in an artistic way, but then also in a kind of political or ideological way, you know, probably reached a high water mark with totalitarianism, in the sense of you can see totalitarianism is coming out of the Enlightenment, the idea that we can systematize and rationalize every aspect of human life, and then we can kind of stratify it and plan it and regulate it.
Modern. America kind of went Locke, but France is also, I mean, the French Revolution is a product of the Enlightenment. I would say it's a terrible product of the Enlightenment, but nonetheless, it's springing out of that.
I agree, and I think you can even push it and say, you know, the Soviet Union, Nazism is particularly interesting, because in many ways Nazism was consciously a romantic counter Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. It was saying, no, we're going back to these mystical properties of blood and soil and of place that cannot be universalized. It's like it's particularized. I mean, Nazism was particularized, and then tried to take over the world. But at the same token, they used all of the apparatuses that were part of modernity. And, you know, that's the, you know, they created an industrial death camp, or death society. So it gets confusing. And I think what we're seeing in a broad sense is, you know, what is postmodern. And, you know, this really, it does come into being after World War II, is a rejection of the idea that all of human society should be kind of, again, you know, that term rationalized or put onto a particular, kind of system, and, you know, where everything is accounted for and everything makes sense and we're pushing in the same direction. There's some kind of direction that we want to be going in. And I think, you know, people in America, it was much more benevolent in terms of, but, you know, you would see this in the way that some people talked about, the corporation, that the corporation would become the, you know, it would dictate your workday in very regimented ways. It would dictate your personal lives and your social lives and your career and all of that. And people ultimately found, you know, first off, it wasn't working, and also it was really stultifying and repressive to have every aspect of your life laid out in front of you, or most of them. And that's where people start to realize, like, well, you know what, maybe, like, I don't want just one system of meaning to kind of control every aspect of my life. Maybe, like you were saying, you know, you can compartmentalize different things you do, or different things you enjoy, or different things you know. We're all kind of like that. And I think that's, you know, that is a fundamentally kind of postmodern recognition.
So, and this is my next question. Who is a postmodernist? Because prior to the conversation with you, I could only identify Philip Glass and a handful of French people trying to get tenure at universities as de jure or legitimate postmodernist. Are you a postmodernist? Am I a postmodernist? Like, would you point out?
You know, just to take a phrase, to paraphrase Richard Nixon talking about Keynesianism, you know, we're all postmodernists now, because I don't think any of us really believe, or we recognize that whatever we're spouting, we need to convince everybody around us. Like, nobody's just going to take it for granted, for the most part. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's a bad thing. You do still see in certain, people don't even talk about totalitarianism anymore. They talk about totalizing systems or totalist systems. And it's, you know, you can see how in, say in like Islamic fundamentalism, where, you know, they're trying to regiment every aspect of their lives in accordance with the Quran. You know, you can see this somewhat in Christian fundamentalism as well, where everything you do has to fit into this larger system.
Right, I'd argue like being woke a lot of the time kind of ventures into that territory. Everything's an extension of this movement.
This is one of the things that's interesting to think about is if everything you do has to, you know, you have to check in with like your main value system. And in a way, you know, when we, you know, there's been a rise in like people wanting to live intentionally. You know, mm-hmm. it's a big thing, both intentional communities, but also just like saying, okay, you know what, every day I want to make sure that I am thoughtful and thinking and doing stuff. You know, that's kind of modernist rather than postmodernist. But when you're talking about, you know, when you talk about like postmodern art and things like that, people like, you know, the novelist Thomas Pynchon was considered, you know, a premier postmodernist. And there's some definitely some elements of that where he's riffing off of modernism and kind of parroting and making fun of it. Novelists like Kathy Acker, who died many years ago, but she wrote, you know, like versions of classic books set in contemporary times, you know, which again call attention to the kind of constructed nature of art rather than trying to make it seem as if this is beautiful and natural. You know, South Park, I think in a lot of ways, when you look at many of the kind of large works of contemporary popular culture, a lot of it is postmodern in that, you know, The Simpsons, South Park, Mystery Science Theater 3000, and these are all, you know, things that really came in, you know, online in a big way in the 90s, but they are ironic in the sense that you don't always know whether they're trying to be serious or funny. They are forcing you to, you know, admit that, like, what you see is a function of your perspective. There's really no bird's eye view in this type of world. You know, I think that's where you can see where there's a lot of postmodern aesthetics that flows from this idea that, you know, our truths aren't what they used to be. We recognize that they're much more limited.
So on that note, in preparation for this, I was reading, you know, the various facets of postmodernism. One of the things that caught my eye was that, and again, it's hard for me to suss out what's actually postmodern and what is an attack on perceived postmodern. But the explanation I had was that if you're reading a book, the book's meaning is not actually dictated by the author, but rather by you, which I look at that and go, well, that seems like a very odd way to approach a transmission of knowledge, that there's not an actual meaning to it rooted in the intentionality behind it, but rather it's just kind of out in the ether and you're looking at it and your truth of it is as valid as the truth of the person who wrote it. Am I right in thinking that that's postmodern, or is that kind of a cartoon of it?
No, I think it's absolutely correct too, because oftentimes what an artist or what a producer thinks their text means or their product is, and then what people end up using it for is totally different. And I'll give you a couple of examples. And, you know, these are not like, you know, deep thunderbolts or anything, but, you know, there's a classic story about that Stalin, and by the way, this is also, you know, I wouldn't say this is all of postmodernism, but it's a kind of postmodern twist on things. So Stalin, when the movie version of Grapes of Wrath came out, he mm-hmm. wanted to show it all over Russia because he, or the Soviet Union, because
show the Soviets how poor and terrible we are.
You know, and it's like, you know, and but the theaters, like the takeaway from people in the theaters was like, holy shit. And, you know, in America, even poor people have cars because, you know, at the end, all the Okies are driving west to California.
And we got mattresses. Put them on top of the cars.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's like, you know, and you know, that's an interesting kind of concept to think about. Like, where does meaning of something come into play? I wrote a story, and this is going back almost, it is 25 years ago, about a series of places where it's clear the audience has a mind of its own. And in the end, unless you believe that the only function of a critic or an interpretation is to divine what was in the mind of the creator of something, and that's all that matters, as opposed to how people use art or use products to create meaning in their lives. There was, in the 90s, this became a thing where there were cheap cigars by a company made by a company called Have a Tampa, and one of their signature products were Phillies Blunts, and they were super cheap cigars.
And well, you buy Phillies Blunts to pour out the tobacco. And, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm cutting you off. Go ahead.
No.
I was like, Philly's Blunts. I know what they're for.
Yeah. Well, what was funny is that the company, they suddenly realized like Philly's Blunts are doing really well, and like merchandise of Philly's Blunts has become, is selling, and they're like, because they had no advertising budget for it, because it was just a cheap, cigar that you would sell in bodegas and, corner delicatessens and stuff. And it was like, Have a Tampa didn't put them out to become receptacles for pot, but that's what they became. And, there's a whole blunt culture that has, built around that and things like that. And, from my point of view, and again, this is less to vindicate postmodernism or anything, but my point of view as both somebody who's interested in culture and also society and the way that people use things, just as people, as pot smokers, would take a pre-manufactured piece, like a Philly's Blunt, and then they would, kind of MacGyver it or re-engineer it to what they wanted. We can do that with art all the time, and we should, and that oftentimes is what's most important. I always laughed at, going back in the 80s, I guess in the 84 election, Ronald Reagan took Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA as like a rally song. And Born in the USA is actually a song about an angry Vietnam vet, who's gotten screwed over by his country and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's an angry song. But as far as Reagan and Reagan's fans were, it was like a great rave up to have at rallies.
Yeah.
And, and it's like ultimately that meaning is just as valid. I think.
Okay, to make sure I've got this thing, because initially when I read that, the thing that I sort of reflexively got to is I find that particularly working in the sphere of political media, that a lot of the time, if someone starts talking about intentionality, I get defensive because I know what's going to follow next is a sort of telepathic attempt to explain how whatever deviant position I hold is actually a result of deep systemic subconscious racism. But it doesn't sound like that's the kind of thing you're talking about. You're talking more, I think, about that, someone might create something for one purpose, but the meaning that someone derives from it is separate from the original intentionality behind that purpose of the author. Okay.
And also I would add to that, it's fascinating. One thing that I think postmodern thought has done, and this is certainly true in kind of literary studies and cultural studies more broadly, is that by recognizing that meanings are constructed and created in a particular moment in an act of reading or something, it allows you to also go back and understand different ways in which things were made or created. And so things like the Grimm brothers fairy tales, they're not actually, and this is also true of a lot of American folk music that became kind of sacralized in the 1950s. They weren't actually, the Grimm brothers like made up a lot of their stories because the stories they heard in the Black Forest weren't good enough. They weren't what they wanted as like true folk tales. Mm-hmm. A lot of folk music is like that, where it ends up being, it's created in a moment, as opposed to accurately reflecting an old tradition, that gets brought forward. And again, in any of these things, it's more like when you start to think about the past it's not like you're kicking around in the backyard and you discover a giant diamond or the Grand Canyon or something. It's rather, in a lot of these things, we're constantly creating and constructing and changing meaning over time.
Right, like a simulacrum, which is what a Jean Baudrillard concept, I think. I don't know if you coined it.
Yeah. Baudrillard. The simulacrum is a copy of an original that never quite existed. And, one of the great.
So, Leave It to Beaver would be kind of a simulacrum because it's giving you a sort of idealized version of the 50s, but not really an accurate version of the 50s.
Yeah. And I was going to say a Mad Ludwig of Bavaria's Castle.
Right.
Is often considered like a classic, which is now was the model for the Disneyland and Disney World castles. But and actually there's it's fascinating when you look at the rise of castles in the Renaissance, and after era, where everybody was making copies of what they thought was authentic and legitimate. And then they become kind of authentic and legitimate because they're the only castles around, but they were going for something else, that never really existed. And I think it's useful to think about these types of dynamics. And it's also, particularly in a political sphere, because, when we talk about intentionality, it's also true, laws and customs and, treaties, et cetera, like they definitely, there is an intention that we can mostly dig up and figure out. And we want to, I think that's, it's an important explanation of things. But then we are also looking at how do things actually work in the world. And this is, one of the things that libertarians talk a lot about, which I think is related to postmodern thought or interpretation in a way, is the law of unintended consequences, where the best things, you might want this to work out a particular way, but then, the intentions are totally at odds with the way that a law or a custom gets implemented.
I've heard the term deconstruction thrown around quite a lot. Yeah. What is deconstruction?
So, I mean, deconstruction is, without getting it, like it back in the 80s, people would talk less about postmodernism per se, which was more specific to art and aesthetics. And in this realm, they would talk more about post-structuralism. But they've kind of fused into, roughly speaking, the same thing. But deconstruction is a way of kind of approaching a text. And, it was pushed by Jacques Derrida, a French writer. It was, and then it was kind of mainstreamed into American culture through some of his kind of acolytes and followers or explicators. But the shorthand version, it is a kind of version of postmodernism. And like Derrida would say oftentimes, like that texts mean, like when you start to actually try to make sense of them, they start to kind of dissolve into meaninglessness in front of you, or that words of meaning only make sense in relation to one another. This is coming out of kind of structural anthropology and structural linguistics, and that it gets really hard really quickly to make definitive statements about anything. On a certain level, and it's at its most cartoonish, deconstruction and kind of thoughts that come out of that become also a kind of weird variation on what's called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis in language, in linguistics, which Edward Sapir and Richard Whorf or Benjamin Whorf were two linguists who essentially argued that our language creates reality as opposed to language describing reality or whatever. And the extreme version of that thesis, which is wrong, I mean, is demonstrably and empirically wrong, the idea that which is actually, by the way, is kind of rumbling through 1984, the novel 1984. That's the whole idea of like controlling language, because the theory is if you can control people's language, you control their thoughts, and they can't even think about pushing back or being subversive or anything. But deconstruction kind of is adjacent to that idea that everything is language. There is only text. There is nothing beyond the words that we use to kind of describe the world and the concepts and thoughts of it.
Text is deriving its meaning from the relation to other words rather than being sort of an objective universal thing that we struck onto. Like there still has meaning. It's not, we're not intellectual nihilists with language either.
No, but it's also wrong in the sense of saying I don't think anybody believes that language is a perfectly transparent way of describing the world. You see something and then you start to put what you think or you see or you feel in words. And there's a gap between whatever it is you're looking at or feeling and the words you use to express it. So nobody is super, that everything is objective and clinically and empirically perfect. But it's also important to, point out that like the idea that there are only words is wrong too. And one of the theories, or one of the ways that gets disproven, and it's kind of clever, anthropologists and cultural or linguistic people, there are a number of languages and societies that don't have terms for all of the colors, that are in nature. But when they give people in that world, and if the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis was true, if you spoke in a language and dreamed in a language and thought in a language that only had black, white, and gray as color terms, you wouldn't be able to see, red and green and blue and yellow. But people from those societies routinely are able to sort colors into like piles, even though they don't have a word for that line, for that color. So it's clear that the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis is not quite true.
Yeah, so it's not a complete lockbox. Although there is some element of truth to that. Like I read an article a couple of years ago that I thought was fascinating, and it was describing how in other languages. I mean, most other languages have gendered nouns, mm-hmm. and they would talk to Spaniards about the word bridge, which is masculine in Spanish, and then they would talk to Germans about the word bridge and about it, which is feminine. And the Germans would describe bridges as, oh, they're sleek, they're delicate, mm-hmm. they're beautiful, and the Spaniards would describe them as very sturdy. And so there did seem to be kind of a flavor that was imparted by language. But again, if you didn't have a word for bridge, you could still see one.
Right. And, you also think about, and that is actually kind of interesting, assuming it's true. And it's also, I don't know if it could be that, in Spain, the ridges are, more rocky or, whatever. And in Germany, they're not. I have no idea. But the idea that you can also change people's perspectives through different ways, through experience or discussion. One of the things that is a real challenge, I think, to people, this also, part of what floats around in all of this thought is the idea of the social construction of reality, as opposed to, the idea that, things like gender, and again, you can think about it in terms of there's always extreme positions in a topic, and then there's more moderate ones, but a lot of people and a lot of kind of postmodernists talked about this in extreme ways, where they would say, well, there's no actual difference. There's no meaningful difference, or there's no biological difference between men and women. There are only the ways that we talk about it and the way we construct gender and gender roles. And it's, that's a hard position to sustain because men and women are biologically different.
But this, I've been in the locker room before.
Yeah, but have you been in a woman's locker room?
No, they keep catching me. I've yet to get in one.
You just got to pull it off. You really got to put the long eyelashes on.
Keep getting that horse costume and trying to sneak in.
And then you can be you can also think about in a liberal political realm, it could be that there are differences between men and women, but they do not matter. When we're dealing with, issues of politics or of rights and things like that. So, there's a lot of different ways to do it. And one of the things that is interesting, we're in an era, I think, of where there is an appreciation that biology probably is more important than sometimes we want to admit. And, you go back 300 or 400 years and it might have been that biology was destiny, that, that was just a given.
There was phrenology and a number of things that were, either bunk or taking parts.
But it was things are the way they are because that's the natural order, and a big part of that is biology. And so women, women wouldn't be able to do certain things, and men wouldn't be, men wouldn't want to do certain things because it's inherent, it's essential to our natures, et cetera. And then, once you start to abstract yourself out of nature, red and tooth and claw, when you have cars and you have machines and you have more free time to do stuff, you realize, well, no, actually, a lot of this stuff is up for grabs, and a lot of women want to do stuff that is considered masculine, a lot of men want to do things that are considered feminine. And then, there was a period, and this was certainly the case in anthropology, particularly after World War II, because the Nazis were so, their whole philosophy was based on, biology as destiny, ultimately, and you were either German or not. If you were Jewish, that was really bad. But they had, they had a whole kind of racial declension.
Like a pyramid,
And so anthropology, one of the things in looking, it started out as a kind of search for universals, human universals. And then it for a period, partly in revulsion to, Nazism and racism, scientific racism that built up in the 19th and 20th centuries, they were like, no, well, it's all culture. There is no, it's all nurture. There's no mm-hmm. nature. I think we're now at a phase where sometimes the nature stuff gets pushed a little too hard, but, there's a recognition that if evolution is true, we are evolved to have certain types of limits on our behavior, and that exists not just for humans as a species, but, the constituent parts. And finding exactly what is a limit and what is just a perceived limit is interesting. And, and that's where I think a lot of libertarians and certainly a lot of conservatives recoil from the idea of the social construction of reality, because in its extreme form, it leads to odd things where it's, saying that men and women, are equally can equally have children, or, you know, that there are no meaningful differences, which just in medicine, you know, like because of our hormonal, general hormonal makeups, like some things that work for women don't work for men, et cetera.
Yeah,
like
I would assume that, that some amount, I'm clearly not a doctor or a scientist, but I would just assume that if you've got a lot more testosterone or a lot more estrogen, that's probably going to have some kind of behavioral difference.
Yeah. But then, you know, it's also, I mean, and this is what's interesting, and I think it brings us back to kind of a libertarian postmodernism. Friedrich Hayek talked a lot in his work on a theoretical level, what he called methodological individualism, that when you're dealing with social phenomenon, the proper unit of study is the individual. Mm. And it's true that an individual is going to be more likely or less likely to have certain characteristics depending on, you know, whether they're male or female, whether they're young or old, whether they're, you know, whatever. But that in any given moment, like, you know, the individual might be an outlier. And
right.
So...
Or it could just be a question of sort of a probability axis where, on average, you know, the strongest male is probably going to be stronger than the strongest female, but there's also plenty of women that could absolutely mop the floor with me in a fight.
Right.
So it's not like everybody's in a box.
You can't get out of that locker room.
Exactly. It's good that I've never gotten into it.
It is, you know, one of the things I think about in this is just because I lived through the transition, but like when I was in high school, I'm 55, and when I was in high school and college and, you know, in my 20s, I guess, for the most part, it was a given that girls couldn't, you know, in track and field meets in high school and college and stuff like that, they couldn't do pole vaulting because female bodies just aren't strong enough to do that. And of course, it's like, It wasn't biology. It was custom and tradition that was then naturalized and normalized and like kind of biologized. And now, you know, women do pole vaulting. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, and certainly I know I can't.
There are lady
vaulting.
Doctors, lady congressmen. There's all sorts of things that were thought to be biologically deterministic that were confirmed to be actual just social assumptions.
And this is, you know, the other thing that is fascinating, and this is where I think on the, you know, within the politics of kind of intellectuals and the academy, one thing that's interesting is that, and I noticed this first when I was in grad school, that one of the ways you knew you were educated in America is that you believed in evolution, because only kind of hicks and yokels and Christian fundamentalists didn't believe in evolution. But at the same time, you would deny that evolution had any meaningful impact on, you know, how the sexes acted, or, you know, like the predilections you might have or anything. So it was this odd kind of negation of the thing that made you know you were smart and your tribe was the smart tribe was, well, we believe in evolution, where all of these other people are like, no, I don't believe in evolution. But then you would deny in any given moment that evolution had any impact or any meaningful effect on humans. And so it's, you know, kind of,
I have noticed a lot of philosophical contradiction there. That is something that has been on my radar occasionally. Nick, I'm going to cap it off there because we do have to close the program down due to unrelated studio logistics and all that kind of stuff. But I've enjoyed speaking to you tremendously. Thank you for coming on the program. I feel
my
smarter.
Pleasure.
And I'd kind of hoped I was going to come into this truly hating and despising postmodernism. I don't have that. I think I just came out with more knowledge of it. So I guess thank you for that.
You know, this is the beauty of antidepressants and modern pharmaceuticals. You know, is that like everything is like nothing's great, but nothing's so bad, right?
That's right. Yeah. I'm just living in a very pleasant, warm gray. All right, Nick. Thank you so much, Dr. Nick. Remember, you can always tweet me at Mighty Heaton or Facebook me at facebook.com/MightyHeaton or even email me by subscribing to my newsletter at MightyHeaton.com and just replying when I send it out, usually on Fridays. I'd also like to encourage you to subscribe to Blaze TV and download the Blaze TV app. If you do, you can watch me instead of just listening to me. Use the promo code Heaton to get $10 off your annual Blaze TV subscription. I look like some sort of 19th century Scottish James Bond villain. And you could tune in and watch it. So download Blaze TV app on iTunes or Google Play, get subscribed to The Blaze, and then fall in love with me more than you already are. You can also watch portions of the show on Facebook Watch by going to facebook.com/HeatonTV. Finally, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. That helps other people discover this political orphanage you and I are hanging out in. Good day.